Welcome to the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham. Each week, Jess and Julia sit down with Hollywood's biggest names to discuss their current projects and take a trip down memory lane as they dive deep into their classic catalogs. SiriusXM presents the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham. Now, here are your hosts, Jess and Julia.
I've always been such a fan of his. I think he's such a talented actor, a funny actor, a great activist and humanitarian. But he has written a memoir that is so much fun and illuminating and enlightening and moving and funny. It's called You Can't Be Serious, and it is out now. Cal Penn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for what a kind introduction for the book.
So the reaction you must feel like has been really phenomenal. I mean, I think people are really liking this book.
I've been very happy and thankful with how much love I've been getting from the book. And I think, you know, we were just talking offline that the I wanted the reader to feel like we were having a beer together when you're reading it, like very conversational. And so it's been so nice to hear that that's kind of how people have been receiving it, because you never know. I mean, I've never written a book before. Most of the stuff I've written has been like weird characters and scripts. So so it's been a really fun week.
Well, when, Cal, did you realize, oh, I get an added laugh with footnotes? Because throughout the book, you get these footnote moments where you're telling a story and then it has like, you know, a four next to it. And then down below, you're like, that's not true, or XYZ, or, you know, whatever. And it like would make me laugh almost every single time.
I know, every time.
Information. It's so great. But at what point were you like, oh, this is a great joke for me personally to do to the reader?
You know, the first one of the first drafts had a lot of parentheticals, and I realized like that just doesn't work, because and it's how my brain works, right? Like I want to say one thing, but then half the time I'm also thinking of this other thing to add to it. And there have been a couple of authors who've used footnotes for different purposes, and I was like, I kind of want to try and see if that works. And it seemed like it was a fun way to just add information. Like you said, I talk about not to ruin this joke for you, but it's by the way the only thing that my parents had a note about for the book. Oh. Is I call out a cousin of mine for catching gonorrhea during the pandemic. I go on about how he caught gonorrhea, and then in the there's a tiny footnote that's just like, by the way, he does not actually have gonorrhea. He never caught gonorrhea during the pandemic. But no, like very few people read footnotes typically, so I figured that was my way of getting revenge at my cousin for something else.
And wait, what was the thing you were getting revenge on him for? Because you've explained it in the footnote.
Yeah, it started when he was in college. It started as like a contest to see who can throw water in the other person's face when they're not expecting it. And it just graduated to like pranking each other at funerals, to which, by the way, he pranked me at his own grandfather's funeral. And so I thought the only way to get back at him was to tell everybody that he had gonorrhea in my book.
Set the bar high.
Only, yeah. Yeah, only if you read the footnote do you know that he's not riddled with gonorrhea right now.
Exactly.
So just for anybody who's not as familiar with you as I was before they read the book, this is, you grew up in New Jersey, your parents both immigrants, and then you moved to, you know, you just decide, you know, in spite of all the people telling you no, at that time, that you were going to go to Hollywood and you were going to make it as an actor. And then ultimately you were on House, the TV show, and decided you were going to leave and you were going to go work in the White House, because you were always torn between wanting to do acting and also public service. And you spent 2 years working in the White House and not volunteering, actually working in the White House. So it's a great story, not only because you've done interesting things, but because of a lot of really interesting things that you went through. And I want to get more into that, but I also want to be the 20th person today to ask you if Cardi B is going to officiate your wedding.
I mean, I think she she said she was down, which is amazing. We just, you know, we're going to wait until COVID's a little bit better to even think about planning it. But I absolutely intend to reach back out to her. She's wonderful. What a nice.
I mean, sweet that'll be a treat, honestly.
Absolutely.
What made you decide to write the book? When did you first start thinking about doing it?
You know, the first time anybody had mentioned writing the book was I've only had one manager through my entire acting career. And I describe him in the book this way, but it's true. He is like every character from the HBO show Entourage in one person. So he's a ridiculous human being. He has a heart of gold. He's also a lion. So he called me the day that I left my White House job when my sabbatical ended. I had a job lined up on How I Met Your Mother, which was wonderful. And he calls me, I'm still in DC, and he goes, hey, you need to write a book. There's literally has never been an actor who has gone in to politics, and now you're coming back to acting. And I kind of paused for a second, and I was like, dude, the governor of California is Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's not as unique, but I see your point. And he said, you have to write a book. I kind of thought for a second, to be perfectly honest, I didn't take a sabbatical from acting because I wanted to write a book about it. I genuinely thought it was the right thing for me to do at the time. It was a historic moment. There were a number of reasons to do it. So I said, no, I don't want to write a book. So about 4.5 years go by. And then I kind of thought, I do have a story to tell. And something sort of clicked where I thought I'd like to write a book for the 25-year-old version of me, right? The kid who's a young man of color trying to navigate Hollywood. There aren't really stories you can point to, or there weren't for me stories I could point to say, here are some of the pros and cons, the sacrifices you might have to make. And then this other category of person is anyone who's ever been told that something that they want to do is crazy. You know, a lot of us have multiple passions. Maybe you don't see the world as binary, or maybe you don't see your choices as mutually exclusive. And especially coming out of this pandemic, so many people are switching jobs, you know, taking that crazy class that you always wanted to take, doing something that's a big risk. And I thought, if I can share my journey with people in that way, then maybe there is a story to tell there, and decided to write the book.
Well, and I also love that you describe in the book how you, you know, found the drama club and you acted as the Tin Man in The Wiz. And that was big for you because it's a character with confidence. And you're like, it's fine because literally people aren't going to see me from the school because only parents spend the $4 to come see other kids. Like, the bullies aren't going to come see me. And then, of course, they're like, you have to do it in front of the school. But it ends up being a really positive thing for you. If you would kind of regale us with your time as the Tin Man.
Yes, and you are welcome. I did play the Tin Man. Okay, so I don't know where you all went to middle school, but the drama club was not where the cool kids went, okay?
It was anywhere that's the case, right? I mean, yeah.
So if you did a school play, you had to deal with soccer players on the bus ride home, the late bus home. By 2021 standards, it was called bullying, but in when I was a kid, it was just called being in middle school. So, you know, we were tormented every day, and I played the Tin Man and thought, you know, the parents who are going to come see the play will be very kind to us, but the director said, hey, you're doing three scenes. You guys are all doing three scenes from the play in front of the whole school. And we said, no, absolutely not. You can't force us to do that. It would be, it's a nightmare. And in those three, the third scene was the only one I was in. And it's the scene in which the Tin Man gets his heart. And I was very nervous. And the line as scripted is, all you fine ladies out there, watch out. And the Tin Man's supposed to look at the audience and smile. And it shows that he's capable of love now that he has a heart. Well, I instead experienced what I guess actors call being in the zone. And I didn't, 14-year-old me didn't know what this was. So I get my heart and I say, all you fine ladies out there. And for some reason, I hold up the Tin Man's axe. I do a gigantic pelvic thrust towards the audience and I go, watch out. And the girls start screaming. The crowd goes wild. I immediately snapped out of it and thought, oh, man, I'm going to get in so much trouble for doing this. And the assembly ends. The director thought it was funny, thankfully. And on the late bus home that day, all the soccer players started applauding. And I thought it was a joke. I was waiting for like the other shoe to drop. I was waiting for the spitballs to kick in. And they said, that was really funny. Why didn't, you know, we had no idea that that's what you guys were that's what you guys were doing, that you were making people laugh that way. And that was obviously didn't have the words for it at 14, but that suspension of disbelief that that art can create, the idea that you can break down some barriers just with a simple joke, that was, that felt like magic. I'm like, I want to do that.
You're listening to the Jess Cagle Show with Julia Cunningham. We are here with Cal Penn, who's, you can't believe how good, I mean, you always knew he was really talented as an actor, but he's written a memoir called You Can't Be Serious. And it really is just a joy, this book. I mean, it's not short, and yet it's a quick read, which is the greatest compliment you can pay a book. One of the things, there are just so many, just every single page is a good story, and it's so funny and enlightening. But you talk about, and I always find these stories fascinating. So you'd been working in Hollywood. You'd been to UCLA. Your family was horrified. You wanted to be an actor. You were struggling to become an actor. And then you get Harold and Kumar. And for like miraculously, somebody makes this movie that has two Asian leads in it, which is landmark cinema. It turns into this huge hit, and you're a big star, and yet you still like can't pay your rent because it was your first. It was like you were, and you start looking for other like make ends meet jobs. Because you always wanted to work at Chick-fil-A. I'm kidding. But you you start looking for you know, you're a big star, but still like looking to become a barista. Tell me about that weird time in your life.
So this is like, this happens to so many actors, and it's funny because it's never something they tell you in film school. So like the, you know, we did the first Harold and Kumar movie. It tanked at the box office, by the way. But my goal when I went into acting or in the arts was, you know, it, you're a success if you can pay your rent from your art. So my only goal was really like, can I put a roof over my head and pay for groceries and gas money by acting? And the Harold and Kumar movies, you know, they of course made a lot of money for the studio, but your first few movies, every actor knows, you know, you sign a contract, you make a sort of minimum salary that the Screen Actors Guild sets. And then everything else goes to the studio. And that's, you know, you negotiate that. That's all fair. But what they don't tell you is that if the movie does well and if you're recognizable, the challenge is you're not going to be able to go back to your job as like a runner or making coffee for people or a service profession, because understandably, like Jamba Juice doesn't want to hire you to make juice because you're going to be distracting. Like people might be like, is that Kumar making Jamba Juice? I want a picture. And the second they want a picture, then you're not making enough juice. And then they're just like, why did we hire you in the first place? So I had no clue until I think we made probably, I mentioned in the book, it was something like 5 months of rent, right, for that movie, which is amazing. Like, that's incredible. I was so happy. But at the end of 5 months, I was like, all right, well, what am I supposed to do now? I can't get a job at Jamba Juice. I have no other skills. What's happening here? And it's in talking to other actors since, it's like, oh yeah, you went through that too? Yeah, me too. It's like, all right, note to film schools out there, you should just tell your acting students that that's a thing, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah, you may get really, really lucky, but you're still poor. Just for like, don't forget. Right?
It's such a crazy thing. Every art, I mean, musicians are the same way. Your income comes, you save it all and you hope it works out.
I also loved the stories when you were working in the White House. Anything having to do, you were actually, this was your title. Okay. President's liaison to young Americans, the arts community, and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Like that was your title, right?
Yeah, there were three separate jobs in that. So it's not young Asians who are into the arts. It's young Americans and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders and the arts community. Yeah, it was.
Sounds busy.
It was very busy. We all multitasked. I was in the public engagement office, which is the outreach arm of the White House. And each staffer had multiple portfolio issues or groups that they did outreach to. And the types of stuff that I worked on, you know, because I was a mid-level staffer, the kinds of things I worked on were never, or very rarely, by the way, like vitriolic or sexy enough to be on MSNBC or Fox or CNN or anything like that, but they were really meaningful. It was, you know, being on the outreach team around doubling the Pell Grant and student loan reform, or, you know, the Dream Act, which unfortunately failed, that would have helped immigrants, or the, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, the Affordable Care Act. Getting to see all that stuff firsthand was wild and really eye opening. But I also put my foot in my mouth quite a bit through the two years there.
Well, I also loved, so whenever there was a Hollywood issue, they would come to you, right? So Haiti is devastated. You don't name the actor, although I think I might know who it is. But there was some Hollywood actor after the Haiti earthquake in 2010 decided, oh, I'm going to go help. And I'm also going to fly my private jet to land in Haiti, which was a bad thing because the airport was all tied up, and if that plane landed, other help couldn't get in. So they have you calling Hollywood to try to get this actor from landing that actor's private jet in Haiti. And I love how you say when the White House calls Hollywood, it's the only place where you get put on hold.
It was wild. And by the way, I should be clear. I very rarely actually worked on anything related to Hollywood. The nice thing about the arts portfolio is it mostly had to do with small community arts organizations or arts education or cultural diplomacy. But the exception, you're right, was when the Haiti earthquake happened. It was sort of this all hands on deck approach. We're one of Haiti's only allies. And, you know, the idea that it was really important to fundraise and to make sure that folks were taken care of was something that kicked into gear. And so one of the things that came across my desk was, yeah, there was a very well-meaning actor who was trying to take his private jet to Haiti to be a hero, to dig people out of rubble and whatnot. And the challenge there was because the earthquake was so devastating, there's no fuel on the ground in the airport. So planes that would land wouldn't necessarily be able to take off. So there's a finite capacity of runway space. And we needed real aid planes to be able to land with as many people as possible. And it seemed like this person was maybe paying off the Haitians who controlled their airspace to land the plane. So someone from the National Security Council called and said, can you call his agent? And I said, sure. And there are a couple of experiences like this in the chapter. I call and the assistant's like, sure, please hold. And they put me on hold. And they come back. They're like, sorry, who's this again? I'm like, hi, my name's Calpin. I'm calling on behalf of President Obama from the White House. Oh, yeah. Okay. Hold on. Sorry. He's in a meeting. Can I? I'm like, okay, well, I really need to talk to him. Okay. Well, just hold on for one more second. Right. And meanwhile, while I'm on hold, there are other people who are emailing, again, very well intentioned. But I remember so clearly, the phone was ringing on the other line while I was on hold with this agent. And it was a well-meaning PR person who said, she goes, I have an idea, like how we can help. I'm like, yeah, sure. How do you want? Yeah, so like, you know how like we have all these heels, like, you know, like you go to events and like you have all these shoes, and we have all these heels. And I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, like we should send them to Haiti. Because those people, we should call it Heels for Haiti. And I was like, oh, no, this is, but you can't say, like, what I wanted to say as a human was, what the fuck is wrong with you? But what, say that. So instead, because I was a government official, I had to say, thank you so much for your wonderful idea. Please email me so that I can. Anyway, so I click back over and the assistant finally puts me through the agent who says, oh, this person is just going to do what they want. You know, we can't and wouldn't give me his cell phone number. So the sort of big takeaway from that, and to, again, to be fair, so many people in Hollywood were so generous with fundraising around Haiti, but it was really, really tough to know that the industry that I love so much was the only one that would put you on hold if you were calling on behalf of the White House.
Well, I was going to say one thing that I love from your book is also just like the minutia of the working in the White House, that like people would just send you insane emails that would say things like, I've been leaving you voicemails and I need to speak to President Barack Obama, and then have a signature that was like 10 pages long and just like insane. But also that everything is just in shorthand because everyone's so busy. So like you can see right through emails because everyone is just like POTUS this time meeting, you know, XYZ. And and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front was known as MILF and was constantly being put in emails as MILF.
That's why I'm told, by the way, people have enjoyed these chapters in the audiobook because I get to do the voice. All about here, Heels for Haiti. So I guess that's a plug for that. You can download it if you want. But you're right. There was an email I got, the National Security Council sent. There were like 80 people on it. And it said, hey, Cal, you need to know about the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And in parentheses, it said MILF, because everything in government is acronyms. And then the rest of the email was basically like, MILF is dangerous. MILF recruits young men. Many young men grow to with MILF. And without thinking, I just hit reply all and I wrote, whoa, their main terror group are the MILFs? Amazing. And as soon as I hit send, I was like, no, why did I do that? Nobody said anything to me on email, except for one person actually who said, looks like Cal Penn is in the building. But in the hallway, everyone was like, yo, we were all thinking that. That's who, isn't that crazy? But like, you know, on the one hand, the stakes are very high. This is a very serious organization. On the other hand, you know, sometimes MILF. I put my
You gotta call it something else. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
and that's a man,
right? Call it that.
Yeah.
And here is the so you fought. You're in Washington D.C. You meet someone. You fall in love. His name is Josh. And I just can't get my head around that on your like. Not your first date, but the first time he came over, he immediately turns to NASCAR. He immediately turns the TV to NASCAR. And literally the first time that's ever happened on a gay date in the history of the world.
Well, the thing about being a White House staffer is it's really only Sundays that you have off, right? And those Sundays are for like grocery shopping and doing your laundry and all that and trying to squeeze in a date. So I was like, why don't you just come over? We'll have a couple beers late afternoon and that'll be that. And he comes over with an 18-pack of Coors Light and changes my television from SpongeBob SquarePants to NASCAR. And my first thought was, all right, well, this dude's obviously leaving in 10 minutes with 16 of those beers because this is just not going to work out. I didn't grow up watching NASCAR. We ended up bonding off of the fact that, you know, Josh grew up in rural Mississippi. They didn't grow up with a lot of money. Their family vacations were to campgrounds around NASCAR tracks. And in my case, my parents are immigrants. You know, my dad talks about how he moved to America with $12 in his pocket. So when we grew up, camping was an economic way of spending time with the family, and I didn't ever expect that we would bond off of a story about camping around NASCAR. But like many couples who are from completely different worlds, sometimes it's the crazy thing that brings you together. So I wanted to share that in the book because it seemed like a lot of people oddly could relate to it.
It's I think about my husband who's always doing sporty things and outside and. Yeah, it was. I know your pain is what I'm saying. And football and watches football, but not NASCAR. I feel like that's out there.
I grew to love NASCAR. There's so much physics in it and velocity and just stuff that I mean, by the way, I'm really, truly awful at math. But I'm fascinated that you need to know all those things to do well in the sport.
It really is remarkable. Cal, when you think about you, obviously the book is a lot about your upbringing at a time when visibility for a young kid like yourself was limited to Apu and, you know, people eating monkey brains and Indiana Jones, and how times have changed and how the world has changed largely because of a lot of the work you've done. And I think that this book is will have a tremendous impact on a lot of young people, in addition to being just incredibly entertaining. So thank you for it. It's great.
Thank you, Jess. I appreciate it very much. Thank you for the kind words and for having me.
This has been the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham, a SiriusXM production. Hear new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.